From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. How's the state of Michigan's economy and what's the budget priorities? We asked.
We will talk about those priorities as we move into her budget presentation in the next couple months, and we will work on those in a bipartisan fashion.
The partial federal government shutdown now means some people won't get to buy new Michigan beer.
Effectively, it's not allowing us to send brands out of state that we'd like to in order to grow our brand elsewhere.
A conservative Republican and a progressive Democrat stand together to end civil asset forfeiture.
There were nearly 1,000 cases just last year where people lost their property.
And we talked to the first person from Saudi Arabia to be named a Rhodes Scholar. You might know her from NPR's Radio Diaries as she talked about her life in a country which is known for oppressing women.
I also communicated the fact that I was generally happy with my life.
Welcome to Stateside. Hi there, I'm Lester Graham. Twice a year, the state of Michigan holds what's called a consensus revenue estimating conference. Basically, budget people and economists get together to try to predict how the economy will fare and how much tax revenue will be coming into the state. The first conference for this year took place today at the Capitol. Representative Shane Hernandez is the chair of the House Appropriations Committee. His committee needs those numbers to determine what will fit the annual budget for the state. Representative Hernandez joins us now. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So what is the consensus, the overall assessment of Michigan's economy to start with?
Well, today's revenue estimating conference is the first step in a process, but I think the numbers we saw today show Michigan continuing to move in the right direction. But there's obviously a lot of work left to do to keep us moving on that path. We have to continue to spend our taxpayers' dollars wisely and continue to move Michigan in the right direction.
Did the economists or the state fiscal agencies wave any yellow flags, offer any warnings or cautions, something like that?
Well, I believe right now what we saw was, again, continued growth in Michigan, a little bit slower than what we've seen in the past, but it continues to show us moving in the right direction. And with this being the first step, it just shows that we have to keep having fiscally responsible budgets that help push us further in that direction.
Jonathan Osting in the Detroit News mentioned GM layoffs could cost the state something like 16,000 jobs. What's the rest of the state's employment picture looking like?
We showed continued growth in employment overall and continued good numbers in unemployment. So I look forward to continuing this process down the road. I look forward to the next step where we can see the governor's budget and make sure we address these issues so that we can continue a strong jobs economy in Michigan.
Well, the budget is going to depend on tax revenues. What's the prediction regarding tax revenues for this annual budget?
Again, revenues looked pretty good in this revenue estimating conference. This is just the first step. We will see another one in May. But Michigan continues to move in the right direction with this.
Additional revenue?
Yes.
Okay. Well, where's that money needed most?
Well, I believe as we go forward, we will work with the governor's staff. I've been able to sit down with her budget director, Chris Kolb, and we will talk about those priorities in a bipartisan fashion moving forward. We haven't seen her budget at this point, but I look forward to working with her on that.
So we don't know what the economy is going to do. It looks like it's pretty stable for the short term, but you know, these are the good times. So I'm wondering, how important is that rainy day budget right now? Should more money or some of these additional revenues go into that?
Well, those are the discussions we'll have moving forward. I want to talk about those priorities with her staff and as we see her, and as well with Governor Whitmer. As we see her budget come out, we will have those discussions. The Republican legislature has shown over the past few years a priority to build that fund, but we look forward to working with her and her staff on that.
You've had some meetings. You've talked vaguely, I assume, about the budget. Do you see any tough items to negotiate there?
I'm sure those items will be there, but those discussions will be had. Right now, we're still at that introductory phase, being able to meet her staff, get to know them and how they want to work through this process, and we will talk about those priorities as we move into her budget presentation in the next couple months, and we will work on those in a bipartisan fashion.
Shane Hernandez chairs the House Appropriations Committee. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
All right. Well, Here's what we have from various reports regarding the state's fiscal picture. The economy will keep growing, but at a slower rate. We're in pretty good shape, but there are some clouds on the horizon, according to one economist, a guy named Gabe Ehrlich, who you've heard on this program. He's an economist with the University of Michigan. He reported the unemployment rate will go down just a little bit more and expects 25,000 jobs to be added in the next year, which will more than offset expected layoffs from GM and its suppliers. Wages are finally rising. They were expected to go up a long time before now, but now they actually are going up. Revenues for the general fund and the school aid fund are not expected to change much from last year. However, the estimates are higher than the last consensus revenue estimating conference held last May, so they're happy about that. The state budget director, Chris Kolb, he's a former legislator. He said when he started in the legislature almost 20 years ago, the general fund total was almost exactly what was announced today. That means revenue has remained flat over a long period of time, causing a problem of constrained resources and additional funding needed to address real problems for Michigan's residents. That might be the Whitmer administration hinting that the state might need some more money to, quote, fix the damn roads, as Whitmer's campaign slogan went. Despite tariffs and trade wars, the national economy is expected to be stable for the year. You know, this all reminded me. I recently gave a speech at the 66th Annual Economic Outlook Conference, and I was talking to a room full of economists. Some of them even worked on these consensus revenue estimating conferences for the state. And I mentioned the possibility of the next recession. When would it be? Who in the room had an answer? And nobody spoke up. They all sat there quietly, a lot of them with some knowing smiles. It is coming. Michigan, as always, will get hit first and hardest because we're so reliant on the auto industry. As the old saying goes, when the nation's economy sneezes, Michigan's economy has pneumonia. Later in the program, we'll get a little more information from a former state budget director.
If you go back over the course of time, these revenue estimating conferences are probably within a percentage point or 1.2% of being accurate.
Coffee shop talk about the partial government shutdown is basically what government shutdown? It's not affected my life. Well, depending on how long this stalemate goes between President Donald Trump and Democrats in Congress, income tax returns could be delayed, although Trump says he might call IRS employees back to work. Food stamps could end. There is a month's extension for the benefits. But here's something being affected right now. Beer. Craft brewers need federal approval for labels, recipes, and to ship across state lines. There's no one in the Treasury Department doing that work right now. Joining us is the co-owner of Old Nation Brewing Company in Williamston, Travis Fritz. Welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
So how is this partial government shutdown affecting your business?
Well, slowly, but, you know, effectively it's not allowing us to send brands out of state that we'd like to in order to grow our brand elsewhere. So the TTB, as you said, is a regulatory agency that the federal government uses to tax brewers and also to regulate labels. That means that if we have a new beer we'd like to put in a can or bottle, we have to pass that label first through the TTB approval cycle in order to have it federally approved so that we can ship it anywhere outside of the state. Currently, we're not able to do that, rolling into a big spring and summer.
All right, don't be coy. What do you want to ship out of state? What is your beer?
So M43 and Boss Tweed are two big brands that we have. We're already shipping those out of state. We have a new brown ale with coffee called Electron Brown that we'd love to get to Ohio and Chicago and even as far as Iceland and Greece, and we're just not able to until that label approval sector is done. It's certainly not as bad as, you know, a lot of things that are happening with national parks or not getting your paycheck, but it is quite a wrench in the gears.
How long can you reasonably wait on the government before this starts costing you real money?
Another month or so. Right now, we're at capacity. Thankfully, we're blessed to be a relatively popular brewery at the moment, so we're not feeling this, but certainly the plans that we have and the forecast that we've made for the second quarter of this year and moving forward will be affected if this goes much through the middle of February.
Even if the government opened in the next few days, I'm guessing there's going to be a backlog of applications just like yours. How much of a delay do you think that will cause?
Well, you know, we've been through these before, and during those times, generally, the wait is extended by about double the amount of time that the shutdown lasted. So you know, the clock is ticking for sure.
How long would that be, like 3 weeks or something like that then?
Generally, they've actually sped it up in the last couple of years. It's now only about 2 weeks to get a label approved. It used to be 7 or 8, but, you know, now we're talking about we're almost 3 weeks into this shutdown, and so we can say 6 weeks is a fair guess and maybe more.
If this partial government shutdown continues for a few more weeks or even months, are you in danger of losing some of these distributing deals that you've made?
No, but we certainly are in danger of not being able to grow in those places the way that we wanted to. And one of the things that we rely on as craft brewers is momentum. And continuing that momentum means releasing new brands. We don't have Super Bowl advertisements. We don't have Clydesdale horses on billboards. So losing the ability to continue momentum like that leaves us in a great deal of uncertainty, and certainly everybody who runs a business knows uncertainty is the one thing you definitely want to prevent.
Yeah, I was wondering if you've been talking to your fellow brewers in Michigan. Are some of them in a similar situation?
I've actually been back and forth to the Winter Beer Conference here that the Brewers Guild and the Master Brewers Association puts on, and yes, everybody who is distributing out of state is nervous. There are bigger breweries, great breweries like Founders and Bell's in the state who are able to plan, you know, 6, 8 months, maybe even a year in advance. So this will affect them more slowly, if at all, than it affects smaller guys like me. But certainly, you know, guys like me who are making 20, 30, 40,000 barrels a year in that kind of middle tier are nervous for sure.
And we've been talking about breweries, but I mean, this affects your friends in the distilling business, wineries and so on, I imagine. So how much of a setback could this be for one of the more successful growth industries, beer, wine, and spirits production in Michigan?
Well, it could be relatively significant. I mean, ultimately, a problem like this tends to accumulate. So everybody has a bunch of little problems, and it turns into a gigantic problem. Because there's only one federal agency that approves labels, you know, the more small problems more people have, the longer it'll take for that agency to solve them. And that ultimately, as you said before, is really where the uncertainty is coming from.
Well, besides sipping suds at the Winterfest, what are you doing in the meantime?
Well, we're continuing to make as much M43 and Boss Tweed as we possibly can. The Chicago market has been hot for us. Ohio, we're going into in a big way here in the summer, and most of their large retail stores. And so we're gearing up. We're certainly keeping busy, and Lord knows we don't have beer sitting in the tank. But, you know, from a planning perspective, this is one of those things you don't want to pop up on your radar when you're running a company of any size.
Well, this is not an endorsement because I can't do that, but I do like that M43. It's pretty tasty.
Well, I really appreciate that, Lester. Thanks. I've always been a fan of yours, too.
Travis Fritz is co-owner of Old Nation Brewing Company in Williamston, Michigan. Thanks for talking with us.
Hey, thank you.
Still to come, lawmakers consider revamping the state's civil asset forfeiture law.
We're one of the states with what we would say are the worst civil asset forfeiture laws, where government can seize and then keep property, transfer it over to themselves, without even filing charges.
Stick around. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. For the first time, a citizen of Saudi Arabia will be going to the University of Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar. Right now, she's working at the University of Michigan. Madge Abdelghany joins us now. First, congratulations on the Rhodes Scholar appointment.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm really excited.
How were you notified? I mean, what was your reaction when you were notified?
We were all standing there, all the finalists. It was after the interviews. We did all the interviews in one day, and then after everybody was done, they gathered us around, and we stood in a circle, said a few words, and then they were like, and the scholarship goes to Miss.
That was nice. Crazy.
Yeah, it was
what do you think impressed them? What did you tell them about yourself or about your work?
It's hard to say. Afterwards, Mr. Charles Kahn, who is the previous warden of the Rhodes Trust, he said that I moved around the world a little bit, and throughout it all, I preserved my identity. So I think that might have something to do with it.
So when do you join your fellow Rhodes Scholar in England?
Should be October 2019.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Right now you're working at a lab at the University of Michigan. What are you working on?
I'm working on studying RNA, which is a molecule similar to DNA, but unlike DNA, it actually goes out of the nucleus of the cell and has its own functions. Well, DNA has its own functions as well, but RNA, I would say, is more versatile. And I'm studying how its structure and function affects the cell physiology.
You know, I've only dabbled covering that particular subject, but I remember it so well because they were talking about hairpin RNA, and they were basically taking lightning bug luminescence and injecting it into corn. It was really,
weird. You could do a lot of cool things with RNA.
I got to take a second here. I want to play an audio clip, and this is from Radio Diaries.
A while back, we launched a contest with NPR to find a new diarist for our series Teenage Diaries. The idea was to find a completely unexpected story, someone we never would have come across on our own. And that's exactly what happened. We received close to 1,000 submissions from around the world. And in the end, we chose this one.
Hello, listener. This is Mist. I live in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. And I turned 19 today.
That's you.
Yeah, it's me.
So you were chosen. Some people might be familiar with you because of the National Public Radio podcast and broadcast. You put it together as a podcast. They kind of reworked it, re-edited it, and turned it into Madge's Diary, 2 Years in the Life of a Saudi Girl by Radio Diaries. How did your podcast and later that NPR broadcast affect you?
I think it changed my life. A lot of amazing things happened to me, and many doors opened to me because of that podcast. One of the things I can immediately think of is that my supervisor right now, Dr. Vivian Chung, who's amazing, reached out to me after listening to the podcast back in 2016, and now I'm working in her lab. So, and the impact that I feel like it had on many people around the world who reached out to me and said, hey, I could relate, even though they were from very different backgrounds and grew up very differently. I just like the feeling of making people feel connected, I guess. Yeah.
I want to talk about your life as a woman in Saudi Arabia. I mean, what we most often hear is that women are restricted. They're oppressed. What did you communicate to the public radio listeners about your experience as a young woman growing up in Riyadh?
I think I communicated my life for the most part. There are some aspects that were incredibly frustrating, like not being able to drive, which is now women are allowed to drive. And certainly you find a double standard in a lot of places. But I also communicated the fact that I was generally happy with my life. And I felt like a normal teenager, whatever normal means. You know, I had dreams and aspirations. And what I think doesn't reach the, I guess, Western perception as often is that, you know, be it a Saudi teenager or an American teenager, we all have sort of similar dreams and similar wants and desires, I guess.
Well, you finish your studies at Rhodes Scholar at Oxford. I'm wondering what's after that. I mean, that's pretty good accomplishment, but there's a life after that, right?
Yeah, I think it's just the beginning. I'm excited to take all the science I learned at Oxford and the skills as a leader that I pick up as a Rhodes Scholar and go back to Saudi Arabia and help improve things there. It's already changed a lot in the past just 10 years. And I'm excited to go back and help make things better, especially in terms of scientific research.
You're married, and you and your husband have been here in the United States going to school. You went to Iowa State, I think, for a while, and the U of M. So you've kind of been going through this experience jointly. How's that working?
It's amazing. I feel like it really helped, actually. Going through graduate school itself is quite hard, but also moving to a different country and you know, just being newly married is all sort of an adjustment. But with my husband going through the same thing, graduate school as well with me, and, you know, us being in the same sort of stages in our career was really helpful and kept me sane.
Well, again, congratulations. Madge Alblughani is the first citizen of Saudi Arabia to be named a Rhodes Scholar. She's currently working in a science lab at the University of Michigan. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
The new Speaker of the House, Lee Chatfield, is a conservative Republican. The new Attorney General, Dana Nessel, is a progressive Democrat. The two of them stood side by side to talk about the first legislation introduced in the House this session. Those bills deal with civil asset forfeiture, the tool law enforcement can use to seize property, sometimes without getting a conviction of a person, and sometimes without even charging a person with a crime. Joining me now via Skype is Jarrett Skorup with the Mackinac Center for Public Policy, a think tank that promotes free markets and limited government. Civil asset forfeiture is an issue the Mackinac Center has written about extensively. Why do you feel it should be changed or eliminated?
Well, from our point of view, Lester, it's a constitutional issue and it's a private property rights issue. So in Michigan, as you noted, we're one of the states with what we would say are the worst civil asset forfeiture laws, where government can seize and then keep property, transfer it over to themselves without even filing charges. And this is not a rare occurrence. There were nearly 1,000 cases just last year where people lost their property without being charged with a crime or where they had been charged with a crime but were found to be not guilty.
So give us a real-life example of how civil asset forfeiture has harmed someone.
Well, there was a famous case in Detroit, Michigan, a couple years back where there were a museum, an art museum, that had an event and students came in to celebrate this. And unbeknownst to them, the art museum was serving alcohol without a license. They were properly getting identification from everyone. They just didn't have the correct county license to serve. And it would make sense, of course, to charge an art museum for not properly following the law. But what law enforcement did was they seized 44 vehicles from the people who attended. And the idea being that these vehicles were used to transport people to illegal activity. And that had a long court case that dragged on. But the result of it was that all those people were offered the opportunity where law enforcement said to them, you can pay $900 and get your vehicle back, or else you can come and fight in court to get it back. And they attempted to forfeit all of that property. We had another case more recently in Saginaw, Michigan, where there was the son of a couple had been on some property down the street from them. So the family owned a farmhouse, and then down the street they had another property where the son was living, and the son was growing some marijuana. And they did have charges and reason to believe that the son was doing something illegal, but instead of just charging and pursuing him, the Saginaw County Police went in and took property from the parents' home, including a classic car and a whole bunch of equipment, and forfeited that from them, even though the parents were not charged with any criminal activity.
So there's a real problem with due process. There's also this issue of when the police agency seizes something like that, they benefit from auctioning those items off. They get part of the proceeds. I think the state's attorney gets part of the proceeds. Why hasn't this been brought up long ago?
Yeah, you're exactly right. So in Michigan, up to 100% of the proceeds go back to the local agency who has taken it. Sometimes you have these sharing agreements in between them, so there's a lot of incentive to do that. Well, some states have tried to reform this. There's about 15 states that require a criminal conviction prior to assets being forfeited. And I should note, this isn't to say that all forfeiture is wrong or illegitimate. There's certainly a case to be made and a need, in fact, I would say, for police to seize property from people who are committing crimes. And if they've profited from those crimes, they should be allowed to transfer those assets to the government to be used for things.
You're talking about criminal asset forfeiture versus civil asset forfeiture. Two different things, right?
That's exactly right. So if it's done through the criminal system with criminal charges and a conviction, that's a different story. The problem in Michigan is the civil asset forfeiture. It's done in the civil system regardless of criminal activity.
Let's talk about the other side of this, because law enforcement has for decades said this is a really, really important tool to them, especially in fighting the war against drugs. So if we eliminate civil asset forfeiture in Michigan, would this hamper police and investigators?
Well, it would certainly make the job of the prosecutor a little bit different, a little bit more difficult if they have to get their criminal conviction. But, you know, we don't let police and law enforcement lock people up without proving criminal guilt, and nor should we let them keep people's property without proving it. But I think that's a perfectly necessary protection for people. But the idea that this really hampers law enforcement, I would challenge that a little bit. Like I said, there's 15 states that require a criminal conviction. There are 3 states that have no civil asset forfeiture at all, including states like New Mexico and California, which are border states. They're big states. They're still doing law enforcement there. I think they're still doing law enforcement well. So clearly you can do so even if you have to get the criminal conviction.
What did you think of Speaker Chatfield and A.G. Nessel, who are, you know, on opposite ends of the political spectrum, standing together, tackling it, civil asset forfeiture right off the bat?
Oh, I think it was great. I was thrilled that, you know, we have a bipartisan era. We're going to have a split government here in Michigan with a Democratic governor and attorney general and a Republican legislature. And there's several issues in particular that Mackinac Center works on, this being one of them, where we've been working with the ACLU and other partners on across the political spectrum. And I remember when Attorney General Nessel came on your program during the primary and talked about this issue. So I wrote that down to make sure that she was going to hold to it, to require a criminal conviction and support legislation that did that. So I'm really happy that she's doing that and that Speaker Chatfield's working with her.
You didn't have to wait very long either. You know, when I first heard that Chatfield and Nessel were going to be standing together, I actually thought it might be a joint effort to strengthen the Freedom of Information Act in the state, another possible bipartisan action this session. Did that cross your mind?
Yeah, it did. And so the first bill introduced was on civil asset forfeiture. And not long after that in the House, there were some bipartisan bills on FOIA reform, open records reform. And, you know, I'm glad to see that there are politicians from both sides supporting that as well.
You know, I remember you mentioned ACLU all ago being in favor of eliminating civil asset forfeiture. I did a piece several years ago with Mackinac Center and the ACLU where you were both talking about these high rates that agencies charge trying to discourage people from filing Freedom of Information Act. So, you know, they're supposed to – minimum cost is what they're supposed to charge somebody who wants paperwork or electronic transfer. But instead, we were seeing I think in one case, the state police wanted to charge $500,000 for documents, and they've all been kind of ridiculous over the years. Is this something that you think we can overcome in this state?
Yeah, I hope so. Actually, we had I don't know if the same situation, but we had a FOIA with the state police years ago, and it was $5.8 million was what they were charging. We were trying to track Homeland Security grant money. There have been a couple of minor reforms in the state to the FOIA law, some with limiting what you can charge per copy and things like that. But the big problem that you're seeing now, and we had four lawsuits in the last 2 years versus state agencies over this issue. And one, which I think we just need to get back to, and I don't know how you do this legislatively, but just the idea that you don't have to charge for everything. You know, you can give out to media organizations and good government groups and private citizens. You can just be open with giving stuff out to people. But then the second part of it is what I've noticed, and we file about 1,000 FOIA requests a year, is that there is just a dragging of giving information out. So dragging it on for a couple of months at a time because there's these wide open loopholes in the law for how long before you actually have to give up the information. And that makes it very costly, means you have to go through a legal process and things like that. And I certainly hope the legislation will help solve that problem.
You know, I filed some FOIAs recently, well, it's a couple of years ago now, and it was several cities in the state. And the different reaction of the different cities was really remarkable. For instance, some of them wanted barely anything. I think Detroit wanted like $5. East Lansing said, we'll give you that information. Then the others, they came up with some pretty hefty price tags for the same kind of information. So it was really interesting to see how unevenly this is handled. You know, one of the bills that's being introduced in the House would mean that the governor, the lieutenant governor, and the legislature might be subject to FOIA laws, Freedom of Information Act laws. We're one of just a couple of states that actually let the legislature and the governor say, oh, no, that's private. The public can't see it. We're doing the public's business, but the public has no business seeing it.
Yeah, I believe Michigan is the only state where we're fully exempt the legislature and the governor from the act. And I think, you know, there might be a couple of minor examples of things in there that could be blocked of certain privacy information. But for the most part, yeah, we've been on board for years with subjecting and making the Freedom of Information Act apply to everybody as equally as possible. And so that's another part of the bill that was a bill package that was introduced.
Senator, Majority Leader Senator Mike Shirkey says he is a transparency hawk. He believes in transparency, but this might be too much transparency. And I guess he's worried about constituents, whether they're business or citizens, and how that might all be open. Do you think he has a good point there?
Well, I think, you know, there's a couple of situations where you need a little bit of discretion, but I think they're pretty minor. So I think if somebody raises a problem and it really is a privacy issue, a real true grassroots citizen, or if you have, you know, we have exceptions in the law right now for people doing bid contracts and things like that for a certain amount of time. And then also, you know, just if you have, well, you know, Mike Shirky, I think, has been pretty good on this. He did sponsor the last reform we had on this a couple of years ago. And I do think that looking over the House bills, they provide for those types of exceptions. So I, you know, I don't know what the specific critiques are besides that. But look, every other state manages to figure this out. I think their citizens are able to engage with lawmakers on a pretty good level. And I think we should pursue that.
Jared Skorup is a Director of Marketing and Communications at the Mackinac Center for Public Policy. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Coming up, how do we make sure something like the Flint water debacle never happens again? We spoke with Noah Hall, Special Assistant Attorney General for the Flint Water Investigation earlier this week, and he had some recommendations. Today, our Friday political commentators have some thoughts on those recommendations.
We have a lot of problems with overseeing environmental protection here and making sure that citizens have a right to clean water and clean air.
That's in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. We talked about the state's revenue estimates earlier in the show, and joining us now to explain how this all fits into the budget process is Al Pasholka. He was a budget director under Governor Snyder, and before that, he was the chair of the House Appropriations Committee. Welcome to Stateside.
Well, thanks, Lester. Great to be with you. And I think Director Kolb had it kind of spot on today. He said things are pretty flat. It's a little tight.
Been flat for a long time, he said. Yeah.
And that's probably a pretty good description.
Yeah. So how important is the Consensus Revenue Estimating Conference in creating the governor's budget plan?
Oh, it is huge. And Michigan is probably one of the few states that actually does this twice a year. So both in May and January, we kind of come back and check the math. And what's really kind of interesting is if you go back over the course of time, these revenue estimating conferences are probably within a percentage point or 1.2% of being accurate. So the accuracy here is what's critical, and as you build the budget, and of course the new administration has got a big job ahead of them because they've really got to come up with a budget in the next couple months.
Of course, they were kind of happy because their estimates came in a little higher than last May's estimates. What do you think were the highlights of the projections?
I think the fact that wages are growing is probably a good thing, and that's what's had the impact on the general fund. And really, the state budget, folks have to look at it in terms of three big pieces. There's the federal piece, there's the restricted piece, and then there's the general fund. And Michigan still, we are heavily reliant on federal spending. About 44% of our budget is federal. About 40% of it is restricted funds, like the school aid fund and the gas tax. And then the general fund makes up about 16% of our spend. And Lester, that is at the same level in real dollars that it was in the year 2000. So think about that. I mean, that's 18 years ago, and even at the rate of inflation, that general fund took a huge dip and is just now getting back to where it was in the year 2000.
So how do you go about putting together a $56 billion budget?
Well, the state budget office does a great job, and you've got professionals that have been in various segments of this budget for years and years and years, and this really is kind of a year-long process that goes about. It's not only the revenue estimating conference, it's how are we doing on our spending, it's monitoring expenditures on a monthly basis to really come up. And then what they've got to do now in a transition, of course, is you've got a new governor, new administration coming in. Their priorities may be different than what the Snyder administration was. So they've got to kind of take that baseline budget and adjust it and try to make it all work. It is a puzzle. And the best way I can describe it to you is it's like a ball of yarn. And if you start pulling one strand of that yarn out, it affects everything else.
Yeah, I'm imagining whiteboards and post-it notes all over the conference room wall. I'm guessing it's a lot more formal than that. I was wondering, do you call all the agency directors in with their own budget proposals or priorities?
I actually, when I was in the budget office, I went out and met with each department. I did meet with each agency director. I met with them regularly, but in terms of the budget, we spent a lot of time meeting with department heads, going over their requests. A lot of times they have different funding pools or different funding sources. So it was really important for our team to meet with those departments as we crafted those budgets. And, of course, Governor Snyder, and I was in the Snyder administration, was actively involved in the budget. I mean, it really was kind of his big thing. I mean, it was all about he was a budget guy, no question about it.
When a governor is putting together a budget, does he or she take the mood of the legislature or the priorities of the legislature and keep them in mind, or is this the governor's wish list?
You know, I think the executive budget has to be pretty much the governor's wish list. I mean, there are some political considerations, of course, that are made in there, but it really is the governor's blueprint. So this should reflect the governor's priorities, and then the legislature can go to work from there. And the way this kind of works with the calendar is, you know, generally the budget will come out in February. Those subcommittees will start meeting. You want those subcommittee budgets to come out right around the time of spring break. And then you've got that next revenue estimating conference in May that kind of finalizes all of the numbers. And that's how you get to the end of June with getting a budget done. And Michigan's been successful in the last 8 years in doing that. As I look at their session schedule for the coming year, it looks like that's the plan again.
Yeah, Michigan hasn't always done that. I think that was partly the discipline of Rick Snyder.
Correct. Yeah, no, I still kid Tim Skubick because he said it would never happen back in 2011, and we had it done, I think, the first week of June.
You know, these are negotiations between the governor's office and the legislature. Do you see in your crystal ball any points of conflict? What are going to be the major issues for the two sides?
It is really going to depend. Now, what we've heard is both Republicans and Democrats have talked about putting the pension exemption back into play. That would hit the general fund to the tune of about $300 million. So if the estimate conference says, hey, you're going to have $260 million to work with, that'll wipe that completely out if you were to make that one policy change. Keep in mind, there are some pressures on the general fund. One is the road package that passed in 2015.
Yeah, that's $600 million, right?
That's $600 million. You've got the Healthy Michigan Plan, which will hit the general fund to the tune of about $300 million. You've got indigent defense of about $100 million. You still have the old tax credits that are on the books at about $650 million. I say that to say this, that it is going to be a little tight. There's not a lot of wiggle room in that general fund budget, even though people say, well, you're spending $58 billion. That general fund is about $10.7 billion. That's the state's checkbook that the legislature really has a lot of control over. The other stuff is federal and restricted money that's almost on autopilot.
As you know, we're in good economic times. We have been for a while. But things can turn. They probably will. So when you have extra money, do you send it to schools and agencies or whatever, knowing that you actually might have to take it back in the future?
Now, I think one of the disciplines that we've had in the last few years is to rebuild the budget stabilization fund. Now, that's something you don't want to tap into unless you really get into an extreme emergency. But keep in mind, in 2011, we had $2 million in the bank, which was about enough money to run state government for 36 hours. Governor Whitmer's coming in with a budget stabilization fund of $1.2 billion. So big difference. So the fact that the governor has paid down the previous administration paid down some debt, put some money aside in the rainy day fund, puts the state in a much better fiscal position.
For those of you who are not familiar with that term, I think a lot of times it's just called the rainy day fund. So at $1.2 billion, we're still doing okay. Should we be adding to that, or is that enough comfort zone?
We spent some time in New York and trying to get the state's credit rating raised. And the number that a lot of the credit rating agencies used for a state of our size was to have a budget stabilization fund of about $2 billion.
So we'd be adding.
We'd be adding.
Al Pachoca is former budget director under Governor Snyder, former legislator. He's now vice president of public relations and government affairs for Conexus. That's a nonprofit economic development agency in Southwest Michigan. Hey, I want to thank you very much for explaining a lot of this to us.
Lester, make it a great day in Michigan.
It's Friday. Let's check in with our regular political commentators. We welcome back Vicki Barnett, the former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. And joining us via Skype is Ken Sikkema, senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican legislative leader. So this week on this program, my colleague Cynthia Canty talked about the special assistant attorney general, talked with the special assistant attorney general for the Flint water investigation, Noah Hall. Noah Hall feels that there are others high up in state government who should yet be held responsible.
What happened in Flint was the direct, predictable, intended result of unconscionable actions by state officials to disregard the law, disregard physical evidence of harm to individuals, and then lie and cover up what they did.
Beyond that, he had some recommendations to make sure that we don't have situations like Flint in the future, and I'd like to get your thoughts on those. First, he thinks we ought to have an amendment to the state constitution, which would make it a fundamental right of citizens to safe drinking water, clean air, and a healthy environment. Now, Vicki, I think the devil's in the details on something like that, but what do you think of it?
Well, I think that we just need to highlight the fact that it's already in the Constitution. Article 4, Section 51 and 52 of the current Constitution, in Section 51 it says, the public health and general welfare of the people of the state are hereby declared to be matters of primary public concern, and the legislature shall pass suitable laws for the protection and promotion of the public health. In Section 52 we talk about natural resources. And the conservation and development of the natural resources of the state are hereby declared to be a paramount public concern in the interest of health, safety, and general welfare of the people. And the legislature shall provide for the protection of the air, the water, and other natural resources of the state from pollution, impairment, and destruction. Clearly, legislative control in the Constitution already declaring that we, the people, have a right to safe air, water, and other natural resources for our use. And the legislature has fallen down on its promise and its constitutional oversight to protect these things. That's number one.
Box checked, it sounds like. Ken, what do you think of this constitutional amendment idea?
Oh, I think Vicki hit the nail on the head. It's already in the Constitution. And as she pointed out, and there are plenty of other places in the Constitution where basic rights are articulated, and then they follow by saying that the legislature shall implement that right with appropriate legislation. So that's really the issue, is, you know, you got to define what clean water, clean air, and a healthy environment are, and that's what you do in the legislature with legislation.
And do you think the past legislatures have failed in that?
Yes. I think it's really clear. We have problems with drinking water, not just in Flint, but in agricultural areas. We have contamination from large animal operations. We have water and sewer systems that are beginning to fail. We do not test septic systems properly on an annual or semi-annual basis in the state of Michigan. And it's a real problem. And the legislature has fallen down on its obligation to protect the people.
Ken, a legislative failure?
You know, the Flint Water Advisory Task Force, on which I serve, really did not highlight the need for a lot more legislation, although we did point out that we need to do more in terms of appropriations and funding clean water. The Flint situation was really a failure of the executive branch of government. It wasn't a failure of having the right statutes in place. It was a failure in administering and executing those statutes.
Well, that kind of gets to the second recommendation that Noah Hall makes, and that's to create an independent citizen commission to oversee the daily operations of the Department of Environmental Quality rather than the governor's office as it is now. Vicki, what do you think of that idea?
I think it's something that we should definitely explore. We have a State Board of Education, which is a separate body that oversees public education. In the state of Michigan, there's no reason why we can't have an independent body that oversees the quality of the natural resources and drinking water and air that we breathe. It can be done, and it can follow that model or other models if a task force is presented. But I want to go back to something that Ken said about Flint. Flint is, as Mr. Hall pointed out in the Cindy Canty interview, that it's the canary in the coal mine in the state of Michigan. We have a lot of problems with overseeing environmental protection here and making sure that citizens have a right to clean water and clean air. And without appropriating proper funding to make sure that we separate stormwater and sewer water and other cesspool infiltration into our drinking water system, we're really not protecting the people.
Ken, we've already got an oversight committee that was just recently created for the DEQ. Now we're talking about an independent citizen commission. I'm not sure who's going to pick those citizens. What do you think of that idea?
I'm not a fan of that idea. We used to have that many years ago. I think it dilutes accountability even further in state government. I'd rather have the governor appoint directors, which he does for DEQ, because then it's clear who's accountable. When it comes to Flint, as the task force said in its report, the governor heads the executive branch of government, and ultimately accountability rests with him. You lose that when you have an oversight body of several members. I'm just not a fan of that idea.
The third recommendation from Hall is to create an environmental ombudsman position, someone who will hear citizens' complaints regarding the DEQ's failure to respond to a concern, and give that ombudsman the investigative powers to look into it. Vicki?
Well, that's possible. We could do that. We could do that now. But that also failed. There were a lot of complaints coming in from residents in Flint and business owners saying that the switch to the new water system was corrosive and it was producing horrible results for citizens. And no one followed up, even the people that were responsible for following up. So there's no reason to believe that an ombudsman would be required to do any different. But going back to what Ken said about a separate commission, we also came up with a problem of, while we had accountability in the governor's office, we had a conflict of interest because everybody was working for the legislative branch of government, and then the attorney general's office is charged with protecting the government and serving as the attorney for the government. So we have a problem. And if we have an independent commission that's created much like the State Board of Education, where members are elected to serve and are accountable to the people of the state of Michigan, they could also do that kind of investigation, follow up, and the ombudsman could be contained in that office. And I think that might be a more independent, better way to go and avoid the conflict of interest that really slowed down the cleanup process in Flint.
Ken, do we need an environmental ombudsman?
You know, of the three recommendations that Noah Hall made, this one I think it does have value. We have ombudsmen in other parts of state government. I know we had one for a while with the corrections department. And I think that has some value. In the case of Flint, because you had an emergency manager in charge, that might have made a difference if you had an environmental ombudsman there looking at the situation. So that recommendation, I think, got some value.
Ken Sikkema is senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican majority leader of the state Senate. Vicki Barnett is a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. Hey, I missed you guys. I'm glad I got to talk to you again.
Well, it was great to have you back.
Thanks, Lester.
Have a nice weekend. Today's Stateside was directed by Lindsay Scullin and engineered by Mike Blank. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia and April Van Buren. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.